Welcome to episode 226 of Reboard Rewind. My name is Spencer Luganbill, and today my special guest is brand new book author, BCBC winner, and friend of In the Money Media. It's Matt Miller. Me and Matt go over three races from this past Saturday at Saratoga for the Belmont Stakes weekend. Those races were 4, 11, and 12, and some angles that we talk about are why Baby Yoda might be one of the better horse for courses at Saratoga of the recent past years. And also, me and Matt divulge into his book, and I try to find bits and pieces that I think will help a beginning horse player. This is Red Board Rewind, the modern racing partnership that delivers a top-class partner experience, transparent communication, and success on the racetrack. Adelphi has won 18% of starts while finishing in the money more than 50% of the time since the club's inception in 2020. Adelphi is more than just a syndicate. They are partners. Adelphi's recent stake winners include New York Bred's Funny How and Pandagate. After his dominating win, the Gandar Stakes, Pandagate and his partners enjoyed a world-class racing appearance in Dubai when he finished third to some of the top three-year-olds in the world in the UAE Derby. Adelphi's practical approach to horse acquisition means their partners compete at the highest levels of the sport at efficient price points. Pandagate, Funny How, and many of their other stakes and high-allowance horses such as Royal Poppy and Gem Mint 10 were all purchased for under $150,000 at auction or via private purchase. They currently have limited shares left in a couple of our recently acquired two-year-olds, including fillies by Twirling Candy and McKinsey. You can learn more about these horses and more by visiting Adelphi at AdelphiRacing.com or emailing founder and or managing partner Matt Couture at Matt@AdelphiRacing.com. It's the same old story. And now I'd like to welcome in my special guest for this week's edition of Red Board Rewind. He is a BCBC winner. He is a new author of a book called A Better Way of Thinking. It is Matt Miller. Matt, how are you?
I'm doing terrific. It's great to be here. As you know, I've been a fan of In the Money for years and a fan of yours for that time. And every time I do a show with someone that I've been listening to for a long time, it's just the strangest feeling. I think the only thing I'm bummed about is that in real life, when you record these things, you don't get the intro music. And I think that would have pumped me up a little bit.
I always say it's hard when I put stuff in post because I always feel like it kind of, you know, either drags it down or helps it up, whichever way. But I've always liked when Pete does stuff live and you can hear the intro music. So, yes, I do agree with you on that. It does get you pumped up for the show. But we're here to talk about your book. We're here to talk about a couple of races from this past Saturday with Saratoga Belmont Stakes races, as crazy as that still sounds to me. But I loved one part of your book. We'll start off how you said, I'm not really a book reader per se, but I knew I wanted to write a book. So kind of give us the context of how the book idea started, and obviously PTF was a big help, and how that moved along in that fashion.
Yeah, look, there's I talk about this a bunch all the time. There's a bunch of Larry David in me, just a bunch of quirkiness and contradictions. I've never really been a reader. Maybe that's a function of being a corporate attorney and constantly reading and drafting documents. So it's just funny that someone that barely reads, and that really the only stuff I've ever read is horse racing, poker, you know, it's Pete's books, Frank Scatoni, it's Steve Crist, it's whoever, but I'm really not a reader. So it's quite funny that once I had the opportunity to stop working and really do what I wanted, turning to a book is kind of crazy. It's actually, in a funny way, it's the way I met Pete years ago. I had a different book idea for him. And so the odds of meeting him 5 years ago, pitching him a book idea that may have legs at some point still, it's crazy that I'm the one that wrote a book first. But it was terrific fun. The stories, I mean, look, everyone listening, just trust me on this. These stories are in you. Just get organized with your thoughts, but the words come flying out. You've You've bent your friends and family's ears so many times with these same stories that you're a pro at this point at telling them. And so getting them onto the page, it wasn't quite as difficult as I thought. It was really great fun.
I imagine it's kind of like you go into that first session, whichever. I know sometimes for people who I know who have written books, they'll do sessions where they'll sit down with a notepad and talk to the people so they can get their notes to start out with writing the certain chapters. And all of a sudden you're like, man, 3 hours went by and we're good for like, you know, a decent chunk of the book. And I feel like if you have the gift of gab, as my parents used to say I had, they said I'd always be good for radio, but maybe not good for TV. So I guess podcasting is a good switch in the middle. But stuff in your book, man, it's just reading through, obviously, like you said, PTF's book. And for me, I remember years ago, someone was like, you know, I see you always bring a handicapping book around. I said, one day I'll count up the pages. And I did. And I think I have like 4,000 pages of handicapping material that I've read through from my, you know, just collection that I've collected through Amazon, eBay, stuff like that. But let's get into some of your thoughts. Millerology, like, it kind of explain to people what that is and, you know, how it kind of helps you in, like, your horse racing career, et cetera.
Yeah, and I'll start by saying that is not a term I would have pompously coined myself. That's a term, it's a term that a very good friend gave me as, you know, in a variety of circumstances. And in the book, the main story centers around playing nine ball, and I'm no pool expert or anything like that, but it was such a good example of thinking differently than other people, getting a good read on other people, you know, getting a read on the situation, understanding the probabilities at hand, and then coming up with your own way of doing it that may or may not be conventional. And I've gone, you know, I admit I'm quirky at times. I've gone my entire life being told you shouldn't do it that way. You're not supposed to say that. You're supposed to do this in this order. I get a whole lot of advice or criticism around how. And I never quite understood what the objection was with my methods. You know, I don't do anything immoral, illegal, whatever. I just do things a little differently. I didn't break any of the rules of nine ball, at least as we had established them on that night of pool. And yet the idea is come up with a different approach, and that approach may crush the conventional method.
Yeah.
And that could apply to a multitude of circumstances. Obviously, horse racing, gambling, those examples are plentiful, but coming up with a fun one around just beating the absolute stuffing out of a buddy of equal ability at pool, him calling in some expert and then beating the stuffing out of that guy and them sitting there scratching their heads. It's great fun. And it has all sorts of applications.
I think pool in general as well. And again, another game you bring up that I started, the whole reason I'm even in horse racing at this point is due to online poker being shut down, you know, obviously in the US. And those games, I think, have such key ideas. And a game, a word that's coined a lot is game selection in poker. Well, you're not going to sit down on certain tables if you see five regulars, you know, at the Borgata, and then they're going to be at your table. It's going to be kind of hard to beat that game. And you talk about it in horse racing as well. And something that we haven't really gotten into as much, but I can kind of bring in here, is you're a tournament player and how important tournament play is and picking the right spots in tournaments and live bankroll compared to mythical. And for me, I really wish, and it's getting better, but I really do wish, if I could go back, I would start playing tournaments instead of doing parimutuel. My bankroll is more, you know, I can still play the nine races for the day. I can play a $20 tournament instead of trying to, you know, oh, I blow my $20 or $50 in the first four races of the day trying to hit a pick five. And now I'm just kind of sulking and I'm pissed off because I don't know what I'm doing as a beginning player. So kind of give us some thoughts on game selection, tournaments, et cetera, stuff like that.
Sure. And look, I don't want to sit here and term myself a likable person. That's up to the reader. That's up to you. I do think I'm a relatable person because I had so many years of doing things somewhat in the standard way or in the way that lots of other people did it. And it really was tournaments that helped me to turn that all around. Something about having a defined goal on the day, which is success in the tournament, looking at the dollars involved in the tournament and the amount at play, and I'm speaking of the live money variety in particular, it just helped tremendously once I realized you can have a terrific time on the day. Part of this game is spot selection. And so being able to sidestep Idiomatic may be just as good as having hit it if she had won. Mm-hmm. And in that case, you know, the fact that you missed that spot, right, you're missing a landmine that blew up a whole bunch of other people in that tournament. And so for me, playing in the tournament, the dollars involved, looking at the prize pool, it helped me a lot with the discipline around how much money to be betting. I think we all struggle with that to some degree. You know, to many of us, hopefully, are at least employing some methodology around betting more on our stronger opinions and less on action bets. But at the end of the day, when you know that the tournament goal is a certain amount of money, it helps you size the rest of your bets. It just, all of a sudden, you have a much better sense of scale and you can see when something is too small or too big to make too little or too big of a difference.
You always hear the coinage, bet a little, win a lot. And I know in your book, you kind of get into that and just, you know, maybe not differentiate from it, but I feel like in this sport, it's so difficult. And how you said, like, you know, finding a goal for the day, especially in tournament play, find a goal in parimutuel play as well. And I know you have a couple examples later on in the book about that on a certain day that you had. I feel like people, they just want to play nine races to play nine races, and they don't really put into the idea of, you know, oh, I'm going to use 1% of my bankroll in every single wager, a la if you were playing sports or something like that. And I feel like it's such a difficult game. A, the skill gap, you have to learn and listen. People take their lumps. I don't think I've really met many people who in the first 6 months are up and stay up where they haven't had that losing streak. Kind of tell us about, you know, your differentiating ideas between bet a little, win a lot, because I know in some of the older books, you know, Meadows books and stuff like that, if you're trying to win $100 a day at the races, you kind of have to put like $400 or $500 in to consistently make that kind of profit.
Yeah. I don't know that my ratio is quite there, and maybe my goals tend to be a little bit more ambitious, but I just, you know, I'm sure PTF would say I'm giving away too much of the content of the book. Sorry, Pete. I just everyone listening, you know, look within yourself. You go to the track saying, I'm going to kill it today, right? There's all these great races, all these great horses. What does I'm going to kill it even mean? Does it mean cashing every race? Does it mean coming home with more money than you've ever made in your life? I mean, is that really the goal? Is like today's the biggest day of your life? I just think that people's lack of focus, how do you know you've arrived if you didn't know where you were going? And so I know it's no fun to limit your upside. I know that. But at the same time, it's no fun losing. It's no fun being up and then being down and saying, what the hell happened, right? I was feeling so good about my day, and I started upping my bets. By the way, on races I didn't have strong opinions about, those were the ones that I hit earlier. Mm-hmm. But I had started upping my bets because I thought I was playing with house money. I mean, we can all relate to these concepts. They're really dumb. And I mean, I've suffered through them for, I don't know, I'm going to do the counting, 30 years, 20-something years. Right. At some point, I woke up and said, this isn't the best way to do this, at least if you're trying to make money. And it was really that distinction of making money versus having fun. I talk about action bets and hunch plays in this book. I do believe those to almost be a necessary part of playing. Mm-hmm. I know that is directly contradictory with what I said before. But if you scale your bets appropriately, okay, if you need action, if your big tournament play isn't until race seven, okay, make a small targeted early pick five bet so that you don't get tempted to do something stupid before your big play. Just make sure not to waste too much of your bankroll in the process. But I know what it means to sit there doing nothing for six straight races. It's almost impossible. And so just be smart about how you handle yourself in that period of time. That's all I'm saying.
And I can't agree more with you. And obviously, me and you being mutual friends of Pete, I just kind of feel like the first few times that I hung out with Pete, I barely even remember that I even had a form in front of me at that point. And now that when I go up there and hang out with them, I try to make, you know, I look at that as I'm up there to have, you know, fun with friends. I have two or three main plays of the day, and that's about it. Because once I try to get into those action bets and I try to, you know, hit doubles, pick threes, etc. like that, I tend to, you know, kind of peel away and lose a little bit more money than I would like to, or have too much, you know, invested. So for me, it's a lot of times when I'm on track now, which is kind of, I think, the opposite. I think a lot more people will, you know, they'll kind of play less when they're at home and more when they're at the track. But I try to, you know, just have good times with friends, have four or five good bets. But Pete always laughs because he goes, I've never seen someone sit on their hands like you do for four or five races. I go, for me, it's I can start handicapping the next day's races. I can start, you know, doing whatever. It's just if I don't like the race, I'm sure you've heard this from my show before. The way I grew up on bankroll management was my dad was a bartender at an OTB, and I at the end of the day, I was the one who went and cleaned up all the bad tickets underneath all the tables. So seeing that type of money kind of, you know, really ingrained it into me, you know, keep a tight bankroll and make sure you're only betting when you think you have the best of it.
Smart. Totally agree. And, you know, you talked about poker a little earlier. I talk about that in the book to some degree. I do think poker players hold just a profound advantage over horse players when it comes to spot picking. Mm-hmm. When it comes to game selection, you know, no poker player plays every hand.
Yeah.
That's insane. I mean, they know they'd be busted instantly. And yet most horse players can't help it but play every race. The question is, how much damage are you doing to yourself in the process versus having fun? And again, it gets back. I like what you said before. You don't even realize what you said, perhaps, but you defined your goals for the day. And you said one of them is having fun.
Yeah.
Well, right. That's a very legitimate goal. Your goal doesn't have to be a $3.26 ROI with a profit of exactly $1,500 on $1,000. No, you don't have to do it that way. There's lots of different goals. And so getting back to your one of your questions, target setting. Yeah, I don't mind doing that. I feel really, really good hitting my number. And it's just simple. How hard do you want to make life for yourself? I could try getting to my number by insisting that I do it via the superfecta. That would be just the most frustrating day ever, in my opinion. And I don't think I'd hit my goal very often. I think that would be a really tough way to do it. For me, it's spot selection. It's minimizing risk. It's taking that former lawyer's mentality. I mean, I guess I'm technically still one, but the whole risk reward mentality and saying, where are the spots that are going to really help me to get there? And if I really want to get creative, and I'm going to give credit to our mutual friend, Drew Cotney, for this, he's taught me, you know, slow down on your aggression a little bit. You can actually give yourself more chances to get to your goal than you think, depending on your bet sizing and whatnot. Yeah. And so going off on him a little bit, with his play, he doesn't do tournaments every weekend, but a lot of his cash play, I talk about this in the book, he does fake tournaments where he'll just set a goal like he would in a tournament, and he'll play his cash play like it was a fake tournament. Well, I mean, there's a ton of benefits to that. First of all, it's great tournament practice, as evidenced by the fact that he won the BCBC and got second in the grade one gamble and has been competitive in a whole bunch of stuff. Mm-hmm. But it's also good money management. It's good discipline. It's a great way to approach things. But again, for the person that just wants to go and fire every time, I don't know that I'm going to be able to talk you out of that if that's really your mentality. But I really would recommend against that from a game selection, money management standpoint.
I can't tell you how many times just being the person, you know, for the bet squad trying to teach people how to gamble, and I always have people come up in the getaway race and they go, I've been losing all day. I need a horse to get me out of the hole. Well, yeah. I always tell people, I'm like, you're in the hole for a reason. I'm not going to be able to get you out of the hole. I'll give you a horse that's like 2-5 to 2, 3 to 1. And then if you want to bet exponentially more than you think than you have, go ahead. But like, I've always hated that the coined phrase of, you know, it's the get out race to make sure you get back to even for the day. I feel like once you've made that mistake, for me, every single day when I'm betting sports now, even it's like I'm okay to go down. And at the end of the month, as long as I have more green days than red days, and it's not terrible red days, I know I'm going to be up for the month. And that, for me, is such a more key context where I think a lot of gamblers and a lot of younger gamblers think, if I'm not up today, June 11th, between 12 a.m. and 12 p.m., I've had a terrible day. Well, if you look at it, if you have one bad day today, but you have six winning days the rest of the week, are you really that bad? I think that's the hardest part, is the mental. And I know you bring up a lot of stuff about, you know, the emotional protection. I have self-defeating behavior is two key concepts too I want to talk to you about. And if you can almost build the quote-unquote perfect gambler, how important it is to, you know, losing is going to happen. I know JK talks about it all the time. You're going to have more losing days than winning days. But as long as you can risk reward and make sure that on the winning days you're really, really killing it, or at least, you know, putting a big hit against those red days, you're going to be okay in the long run. It just takes a while to figure that out, as you and me have always talked about for over, you know, 20, 15, 10 years of doing this.
Totally. And the worst part about these self-declared get-out races is that people get all kinds of weird projecting onto the race what they need to happen,
yeah,
for their bets to work out. So they just decide, this is the race that's going to be won by a long shot. Mm-hmm. And that's just not how it works. And it's amazing. You could look at that person and say, I have a guaranteed 5-2 winner. And there are people that will legit say, no, thank you. I need more than that. And that's nuts. I mean, I guess if you bet once or twice a year, I give you full permission to just maximize whatever you're going to do on the day and, you know, just try and have your killer day and that's that. But if you're any kind of a regular player, if this is anything you do with any regularity,
yeah,
there's no such thing as a get out race. I mean, I guess it would be the last bet of your life. Maybe that's your get out race, but otherwise there's tomorrow, there's Saturday, there's whatever. And so why are you just arbitrarily trying to hammer something here when you're just going to pick up your phone and start again in 24 hours? Yeah. And so there was no need to go do that. And if the horse that you like is legit 5-2, why would you not take that in the last race if you would have jumped at that in the first race? Think about it that way. It makes no sense.
I will say this, though. The way Saratoga does their last bet of the day, and it's usually those crazy maiden races on the grass, 9 times out of 10, it is usually a long shot, so I do give people credit there. But it's such a key concept of, you know.
Let me interrupt you for a second.
It'd
be funny. You just said Saratoga's last race.
Yeah.
That doesn't have to be your last race.
Correct.
And so it's up to you. And maybe it's the stakes race, the feature, the race before that, that you had your opinion. Right. And after you hit that, and you're cashing in, I'm making up something stupid, your $1,040. Sure, take the $40 and go play it on your hunch on the whatever, mm-hmm, in the last race. But something tells me that hitting that $1,000 was probably pretty close to hitting a goal of some sort. And, you know, again, tying in that other concept, you're done at that point. And just because Saratoga says there's one more race doesn't mean you're under any obligation to make that your biggest bet or your biggest hit or anything else. Sometimes just rounding out your balance to an even zero amount and just playing what I call the scraps is a fine objective for that last race, especially after you hit the one before.
Talking about scraps, we can kind of talk about bankroll management before we get into these races here and just how key and how important it is. And for me, betting sports, poker, all of that, I not rules, but it's like, I know what I have. You know, for right now, for me, with sports betting, I'm betting 3% is a unit. If and those are like my top best plays of the day. Everything else is usually 1%, 2%. And it's not fun. I mean, listen, to grow up your bankroll and to go from limit to limit, it takes, you know, a couple, you know, weeks or a couple months of just really, really solid play. And right now I'm halfway to one of my goals for it. And it's like, man, I've been doing this for 3 months and I'm only halfway to a goal. And that kind of sucks. But at the end of the day, I think it's just, it's not a sprint. It's a marathon in gambling. And obviously people who hit, you know, these major, you know, 12 horse or, you know, 12 team parlays in sports betting or hit the pick six on Breeders' Cup Day. Like, it's amazing when it happens. But I've always held charts from Barry Meadow, you know, you're only supposed to hit a pick three 12% of the time. Yet people are overplaying three favorites, you know, on six different partial wheels and wondering why they're losing money in the long run playing pick threes. And just kind of give me your kind of thoughts real quick on bankroll management.
Sure. And, you know, part of that has to do with pool size. I just seizing on the pick three thing for a second. One of the problems I cop up to in this book is realizing that even smaller bettors can have an impact on pools. And especially when you pick on the pick three pool at different tracks can be wildly different amounts. And the way you bet that can have an actual impact on your payouts. So even that's something to be conscious of. You know, for bankroll management, I start with the principle of, we talked about it, if your best bet of the day hits, you need to be a winner, mm-hmm. period. And so it's allocating enough of my bankroll at the start of the day to that, to make sure that that's going to be the case. If the horse is 6-1, all right, it's not that often that's that might really my best bet of the day, but if that's the case, that's a luxury because, you know, I've got a whole bunch of other bankroll to devote to other stuff. You know, I don't necessarily scale back my amounts too much when playing a long shot. If anything, you should probably be betting more if you're getting better prices. But I do admit, right, when I'm getting a decent price, I will, it's not that I get spreadier. It's just that I feel less of a need to expose capital.
Yeah.
Because I'll be happy with the amount I'm getting. Again, it goes back to your goal. And it sure is easy. If you bring $1,000 with you on the day and your goal is to make $1,000 and you have a 6-1 shot that you love, well, that's a pretty easy shot at getting to your goal with having lots of other capital available for other stuff. Mm. That's more the way I look at it.
Yeah.
I guess some people might have a school of thought of just saying, put the $1,000 on your 6-1 shot. Right. We're also trying to balance fun, making this a good activity, you know, going back to something you said a second ago, and I'll challenge you on that. I do think when it comes to sports betting, yeah, unless I'm really talking to a professional who needs this to feed his family, I actually think most people would say, if I was break even 365 days from now, if a year from now I had the same amount in my sports betting account that I have right now, and I've played every game I wanted, I think most people would take that as a win and say they got lots and lots of action and lots of
That's
fun.
Fair.
And so it's interesting. Again, it's a function of your objectives. And if you're a super selective spot picker, right, then breaking even isn't good enough because, you know, you've waited for your spots and they just worked out to be break even. That's not great.
Yeah.
But for me, sitting down on a UFC pay-per-view night and hammering away at some hunch plays. And even if you told me at the end of the day, you'd be dead even, but you hit stuff and you lost stuff. That's a great time. And I would take that. Again, it's a function of your objectives and it's not for me to tell anybody what you should be trying to do. The other question I'll get back to real quickly, because I don't think I answered it fully. It's easier to make money if you have a large bankroll.
Yeah,
it is not that hard to turn a large bankroll into a slightly larger bankroll. It's really hard to take a small bankroll and make it into something big. Just about everything has to go right. I mean, not everything, but way more than your share of things needs to go right. It's actually easiest. And I think in the book, I think I use blackjack for this. If you just take the premise of, you know, $100 to make $1,000 or $100 to make $100. To $100 to make $1,000, you don't have to win every hand, But you're going to have to, variance is going to really have to be on your side. You're going to be have to be upping bets and be hitting those at the right time. To make 100 off of 100, you probably got a whole bunch of shots at it. I mean, you can structure bets in all sorts of different ways to give you a whole bunch of different chances to either get back to even or get back to your goal. You then have the luxury of stopping. And so depending on where you set that goal, it's just a question of how hard you make it for yourself. And for me, this concept of strike rate became something very powerful. That's especially true in tournaments where there isn't another one tomorrow. You know, today's tournament is the tournament. And so strike rate does become a little bit more important in that case. And so even if you have a bunch of good long shots, I don't know that your strike rate on those is high enough to merit making those your tournament plays. All right, that's a wild tangent. Sorry.
No, that's okay. I feel like strike rate is very important. But the last thing I'll bring up too is just, and you talked about with bankroll, make sure your best bet is a winning day and not a losing day. And for so many people who I see, you know, they'll have a 9-1 shot in the middle of a pick five and then they miss the pick five. And I'm like, well, at least you had the 9-1 shot. And I'm like, how much are you doing off that? And they go zero. And that makes me want to like legitimately run my head through the wall. And I've had a couple friends who just in the past few months have been telling me that they've kind of gone with that strategy where they'll have a pick five sequence. They'll play a win bet on that horse that they like the most to at least pay for their ticket, etc. And just last week, someone hit their best ROI play. It was like a $27, $28 ticket for like $1,200. And I'm like, well, did you hit your kill shot too? And they said, yeah. And I said, well, then it's like, it's just more icing on the cake. And how I think if more people listen, hitting $50,000, $60,000 on a pick four, pick five, pick six and all that, it's great. But you can make just as much money in the win pool, maybe not so much now with the CRWs, et cetera, stuff like that. But for me, it's always been, I'm going to have a lot easier time hitting one race than I am hitting six. And I'm sure you kind of agree with that to the most point.
Absolutely. And again, I'm probably taking too much from this book, but I don't really care. We're having a fun conversation. Go back to the presentation, the first presentation you got on investing.
Yeah.
Maybe that was when you got a job and the 401k people came to talk. And they put up a big pyramid on the board and said, oh, all your safe stuff should be at the bottom and your risky stuff should be at the tippy top. And I do think that the average horse player has their pyramid completely inverted. They've invested all their money at the top on the really risky pick five. And there just doesn't seem to be enough glory in the win bet on that 9-1 shot. And so that's getting, you know, a piece of their bankroll. But that pick five ticket was a big one. In terms of cost.
Yeah.
That makes no sense to me. You know, you should be, you know, even if you're looking at it as a sports analogy, if you like six games, I'd be betting my primary game first. I'd be then betting a two-game parlay, a three, a four, a five, and a six. And those should be in order of confidence. And if your top four hit, but that fifth and sixth missed, you should still be making a whole bunch of money. And you can do it the same way, not exactly structuring the same way, but the same concept in horse racing. You love a 9-1 shot on the day and don't walk out a winner. Sorry to be so harsh. You just suck at this really, really badly. And you really need to reevaluate because 9-1 shots are really hard to find.
Yeah.
And if you're good enough to find one, you've got to cash. You're going to lose a whole bunch on others. And so to walk out of there on a day saying, you know, I missed the pick six. I was alive to the biggest score of my life. I just missed the last, right? I'll even talk about another huge sin. I was only able to afford a couple horses in the last race because the ticket was too expensive and I wasn't able to spread enough and I ended up missing it.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, these are so cringeworthy, these words that, right, you have to have a win bet on that 9-1 shot. If you have, you know, it would be great if you happen to catch an interim daily double going into them or out of them too. But yeah, it can't be that you're just letting the whole thing ride on the pick five or pick six. That's crazy.
so much more we get into with this book, but I do want to get into our three races that we're going to talk about today. So we're going back to a good old Saratoga a couple weeks earlier than usual, but we're going to start with race number four from this past Saturday. We're going 6.5 on the dirt. It is the Grade 2 True North. And in this race, I know we kind of were going through trying to pick our races, Matt. And for me in this race, I just kind of thought it was interesting. Gunpilot, the obvious favorite here, going off at sub-even money, improving, won the Grade 1 last time out. Looks like, you know, kind of not the solid favorite you want to see, but just one that you just knew would take money and one that at the price I just had to pass on. I thought Baby Yoda on the outside for Eric Cancel and Bill Mott looked interesting. 3-for-5 at Saratoga. As everyone remembers, back when The Mandalorian on Disney Plus was in such high esteem, this one ran a 114 buyer. Loves the track. Ran a 90 last time out. Obviously is a little bit short, but that was the best figure we'd seen since the Kelso back in 2022. And I just wondered if maybe coming back to a track where, listen, has 8 wins, lifetime, 3 wins at Saratoga, is kind of a horse for course here, and has a nice, nice workout of 47-2. I just wondered if Baby Yoda at a decent price, and in this race we got 9-1. I just thought this one might be able to spring the upset, so I decided to play this one across the board. There wasn't a lot else in this race that really had me, you know, salivating, looking to run to the window, you know, accreditive off these optional 80 races of 89 and a 90 buyer. Just, you know, good job hitting the board, but I just don't see where this is exactly going to, you know, get the job done. Obviously, Gunnett's been in a couple stake races, you know, not as of late, but those optional 80s in the last, won by 2 lengths as a 4-to-5 shot like he should. Had some blue fractions in there. I just thought Baby Yoda at a price with a blazing workout at a racetrack that we're really not usually at this time of year, I thought was very, very interesting. What were your thoughts on this one, Matt?
I love that you picked this race. This is not a race that I hit. It's a race that was relatively painful, but it is maybe one of the best illustrated in this. And to the audience, this was not rehearsed. This is one of the best examples I can come up with for the difference between a good race for playing tournament versus cash.
Yeah.
I was alive in the Belmont Betting Challenge to a really nice daily double here with, not surprisingly, Gunpilot. It was a nice overlay. And again, focusing on strike rate, Gunpilot struck me as the most likely winner. You know, I love the buyer pattern. Mm-hmm. I loved it. Everything about it I loved. I knew the horse would be less than even money. Wasn't too freaked about that once I was happy with the price I had in the double. But, and so from a tournament perspective, I felt great being alive to the second half of a will pay here with, you know, for thousands that it, this would have afforded me another horse in the Belmont probably if this horse had won.
Yeah.
Meantime, playing cash, no way. No way. I don't think the value is there at all. And I agree with you. As you look at the field, by far the upside here was with Baby Yoda. I was shocked at the price. I did mention to someone, you know, someone was asking me who I was playing, and when they said they weren't in the tournament, this was the horse I gave them. I think Marshall Graham even hit this one maybe in the tournament. So mm-hmm. There were some sharp people on this horse for sure. Sad to say, I just wasn't one of them.
For this race, we're looking to get a double done for Matt through Gunpilot. I just had to play Baby Yoda across the board. Let's see who gets it done here in the fourth right now.
We're off in the True North, presented by F.W. Webb. And it's a fast start for Gunnett. Baby Yoda is up and on the pace, too. And just in behind them, Rotney is third. Down on the inside, 90% Maddie. Gunpilot is fifth, and on the outside of Accretive, it's another 2 back to 24 Mamba who trails. Gunnett is the quickest of the quick, heading to the half-mile pole by 3/4 of a length. Baby Yoda in second, Rotney just off them in third, Accretive advancing between horses fourth. Then it's Gunpilot, 90% Maddie. The opening quarter went in 21 4/5 seconds. The distant trailer is 24 Mamba. 3 of them vying for the lead as they come toward the quarter pole. Gunnett, Baby Yoda in between, and a 3-wide Rotney. Baby Yoda takes the lead. Rotney moves into second. Gunpilot still with 4 lengths to make up on the outside, 44 seconds flat. And it's Baby Yoda opening up. Baby Yoda by three. Rodney is in second, but no one's coming close to Baby Yoda. Baby Yoda with a five-length lead close to home. Another dazzling display at the Spa for Baby Yoda, who ran away with the True North.
One. And it is Baby Yoda getting the job done. 102, the winning buyer, looking at a nice win mutual of 20-40. Gunpilot runs third, and I think when I look back at this race, and this is something that me and you can attest to as well, I'm a little bit more of a class handicapper, but we see that they win the grade one last time. How much is a grade one really a grade one now in this day and age? Almost if you're looking through the whole field and stuff, which I did not unfortunately do with Gunpilot at this point, but I just feel like everyone sees the class edge of, you know, oh, a grade one winner compared to a horse that just won an optional 80. But I do think that the Saratoga trends, especially as we've always talked about with boutique meets, you know, if they are a horse for course, that always seems to edge out in the beginning of the meets before horses finally get a couple of races under their belt. I thought that workout for me really put this horse into high esteem. I could not believe this horse went up in odds. I don't know what everyone else saw in the rest of the field. Accreditive runs dead last at 3-1. I thought this was as close to stealing money as I could get on this day at an early race for the Belmont card.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, this is one of those races where for the last 10 seconds or so, you know it's over. And I do think most sophisticated players had a good 10 seconds to say, gosh darn it, did I really blow this? I mean, it was a very lengthy period of time to look at those odds, to look at the odds of the fading favorite and say, how did I, please just let me rewind a few minutes. I'm sure I'd get this if you gave me another shot at it.
And it's such a weird race because both of the horses that are, you know, quote unquote short prices under $10, both did not run the best. I think Gunpilot, you know, like you had said, the improving buyer figures. Now he kind of just runs a dud here. Not one that I'm going to say I'm going to, you know, bet back next time. You know, would do the trips or anything. Like you had said in your book, I'm not the biggest race watcher, race replay guy either. I tend to kind of look at trends and stats and numbers, but I mean, 90%, oh my God, 90% Maddie running second here for Robert Reed. If you look back through that one's past performances, a couple 90s back to back, but at least that was in the run happy and a state bred race at, you know, those 4-1 prices. This one ran perfectly fine and you get a nice price of 16-1 here as well. So, I mean, if you're playing the live bankroll tournament or even the mythical win place, which I know we didn't get much into, you said it perfectly. I think that for a tournament, these are the type of horses that you want to find in first and second, and you're trying to fade these horses at, you know, under even money in 3-1. I mean, Accreditive to be the second choice here. I mean, if you technically look back at it, ran slower than Baby Yoda in the last race, which just blew my mind completely.
Yeah, 3-1. I had no idea what people were seeing. These were weird odds, and I think we saw on the day some kind of weird odds and some weird things happen. You know, I'm no conspiracy theorist. I take everything at face value, but yeah, it's a little weird to see horses drifting up in odds and winning. That's not usually how it goes. So I'll make an interesting note to viewers or to listeners. Just so you know, when you're on the show with Spencer, he does not force you to listen to the actual race, which I'm really relieved because listening to that last one again would have been terrible. So thanks for skipping over that.
Absolutely. Let's move on to the next race, middle race of our recap here. Race number 11 from Saratoga is the Grade 1 Manhattan, 1 3/16 miles on the Mellon Turf Course. Matt, we'll start off with you. You said it, and I'll use a riff here from me and PTF, kind of a skull buster kind of race where you just had nowhere to go in this type of race. Kind of give us an idea of, you know, as you're looking through each horse, what your thoughts were for live play and for the tournament.
Oh, this was just brutal. I mean, I don't have a particular order in which I start looking at the horses, but, you know, everyone's got their processes. They start scanning the field and thinking to themselves, ABC or yes, no, or maybe. And I realized, I think within three or four horses, this is just stupid. I think I started from the outside, right? Begrudging. I love measured time. I look at Farbridge and think, that's not that crazy, right? Nation's Pride looks terrific with Charlie Appleby. Mm-hmm. My buddies on the HHH Racing podcast are all over the six. Program Trading would have been my pick if just completely on my own. And Right. And then I look over to the rail and say, my God, this is absolutely brutal. And so again, and I love that you picked this race for this show. This race could not have been a harder pass. I just looked at this thing and said, if I'm betting with my heart, it's program trading. But with my head, there are way too many with a chance here. I can't make heads or tails of this. As much as I love using a daily double as a final play in a tournament, I couldn't even do that here. Yeah. I would have just been spreading to way too many horses. Maybe I could have shortened that up and played one or two of them on the side, but I thought the odds I was getting in the final race were good enough. And so this to me just couldn't have been a harder pass. And yet again, going to cash. Oh yeah. I could have absolutely seen landing on this horse. I mean, this was a really bettable betting race. If you had a strong opinion, I think I heard after the fact, I could be wrong. You probably know this. I don't have it on my screen. I think I heard four different horses in this race got a buyer of 100 or higher. So if that isn't better proof that this thing was as competitive as possible, I don't know what is.
So when we get past the race replay, I can get more into it. But for my race and just looking over in general, the joke now with me and a couple of guests on the pod are, it's not the other Chad now, it's the other Charlie Appleby. And I've been such a big proponent of watching his horses go and measured time for me coming out of a couple of those grade ones and, winning the 1-2 back at Maidan. And just going through this field, everyone looks somewhat decent. I know program trading won that last time out. I'm not a big proponent of taking horses off slow pace figures. When they win a race, I kind of downgrade them a bit. Seeing that one go off as the favorite. Nation's Pride for me in the last race in the Man of War. I did go with Silver Knot over that one, so I kind of took that as a little bit of a negative coming into this one. For me, it was Measured Time, and it was also the number 2, Ohana Honor. Just such a huge price in Ohana Honor if you look back through. And, 97, 98, 99, not much else you're missing there. And ran, was 10 off the pace in that past pace figures. That's probably what kept that one up in second. But it's something that I've heard from old time racing books is look at the past odds. And if they're hitting the board at 11 to 1, 15 to 1, 20 to 1, they're overachieving because obviously they're not part of the top three contingent there at 10 to 1. So I just couldn't let Ohana Honor, possibly beat me again. So I included that one in a win Dutch with Measured Time. Measured Time did go off right above that 3 to 1 limit that at least I need. Thoughts on any of the win dutching? I know sometimes PTF will do it as well. Do you kind of do that ever when you're playing two horses to win in a race?
I do. I just couldn't do it here. It was just too tough. But I will say, if playing cash, this race for me would have been Measured Time. I thought looked terrific.
Yeah.
I still would have been on program trading. So if I'm not in a tournament, I would have found some creative way to be able to play both of those two horses. The spot for program trading, I thought looked fantastic. I even despite the difficulty of the race, I was still close to playing that. Obviously I'm glad I didn't. And yeah, that I respected my first opinion of getting scared away.
Measured Time, Ohana Honor for myself. And this is a pass race for Matt. Let's see who gets it done here in the Manhattan right now.
And they're off. A picture perfect start to the Resorts World Casino Manhattan. And as expected, strong quality is going out for the early lead. Program trading is up close in the opening furlong. And here's Measured Time galloping up. And Measured Time is quicker than both, despite being under a snug hold. Just in behind them, I'm Very Busy is racing already a bit off the hedge as they move into the first turn. Ohana Honor in the gold colors moves up and takes the fourth spot. That group is followed by Far Bridge, who's toward the back of the field with Alrifa and Nation's Pride. 23 seconds flat, strong quality, wanted that lead and got it back from Measured Time in second. These two will swing onto the backstretch with a two-length cushion over Ohana Honor, who races a joint third. Flavian Pratt has a nice hold of program trading in fourth. Then comes Far Bridge. I'm Very Busy is on the inside. Nation's Pride just went by those two through a half and 48 and 1/5 seconds. And Alrifa, it's a very compact field that comes to the half-mile pole. Strong quality on the inside and Measured Time. pursued by program trading and Ohana honor as they move into the far turn. Steady progress for Nation's Pride, who's up to take fifth, followed by Far Bridge. I'm Very Busy between rivals, and Alrifa at the back. 111 and 3 for 6 furlongs. Measure Time can wait no more. Confronted by program trading as Strong Quality surrenders. The field turns for home, and Nation's Pride is coming after the top pair. A wandering Measure Time is the leader coming to the furlong pole. Far Bridge coming through, running a good race. Program trading is in between horses. They're coming to the 16th pole, and William Buick and Measured Time are home free, turning it on late. Measured Time outclasses them in the Resorts World Casino Manhattan.
One, and it is Measured Time getting the job done. 104, the winning buyer, 820, winning mutual. So I get the lower priced horses. Ohana Honor, I think, does not run terrible, running third in a dead heat. Nation's Pride runs second. I'm not really sure what happened with program trading in this race. Does go off at sub 3-1, but we had a couple other horses, you know, running towards the back of the field that were lower prices. Well, listen, second off the layoff for program trading, maybe that one ran a little bit too much in that first race. But I mean, I wouldn't say going from a 94 to a 102 is technically, you know, terrible. And I'll get back into what you said. Five horses ran over 100. Program trading ran 100. So only dropped 2 points. So, I mean, how bad of a race really was it? It wasn't really that bad of a race. Everyone else really improved. Far Bridge ran from a 95 to 100. Just a really, really fun race. And Measured Time just kind of, you know, blew the doors off him, a la Charlie Appleby style now, where it, for me, it's becoming, you know, Christophe Clement for me is my favorite turf trainer, because sometimes I feel like his horses still get a little bit neglected at the window, especially when he's facing Chad's runners. Charlie here, for this horse to pay $8 to me was kind of crazy.
Absolutely. And it's one of those where, again, looking back, you look at the price, you look at the form, woulda, coulda, shoulda. I probably should have had this one. That's good value for what this is. And I got too taken away by just the really attractive form of everybody else. And, you know, I don't know, maybe it was one of the Matisse brothers, but someone famously talks about, if you're not passing on winners, you're betting on too many races.
Yeah, and that's a great quote.
This might have been one of those.
And I think so too. And you just bring it up so much. These are, we talk about, you know, oh my God, six horse fields and graded stakes, but this is the kind of graded stake you want. Give me, you know, 8, 10, 9 horses, and they're all pretty much equal, or they all have that hard handicapping puzzle that, you know, everyone, when they're starting out, they just want to find the one horse. They want to find the winner. Months and months down the road, they realize, oh, I'm trying to cross out horses and just find 4 or 5 that can win. And then I can start to, you know, implement my strategy or my ideas. And maybe I knock off 2 more. Now I'm down to 3. But if you're getting down to one horse every single race, you're doing it wrong.
You're too narrow in your thinking. It's not possible that it could only go that way. At a minimum, you know, I don't believe in this as a method, but at a minimum, you should be narrowing the race to the best speed and the best closer. I'm not saying play them both, but at least have it narrowed to that, where you can decide based on how you think the race is shaping up, which way you should go. And sometimes it's both ways, but at least think it through.
Let's move on to the last race of this pod, the race everyone wants to hear us talk about. Race number 12, it is the Grade 1 Belmont Stakes, 1 1/4 mile on the dirt. And I'll let you start first, Matt, but before we do that, I just want to bring up, you know, this is kind of the fact for me and the way I've always looked at the Belmont, as this is the race where everyone makes their astute ideas in the Kentucky Derby, whether they're right or wrong. Then about, you know, 4 or 5 of them go to the Preakness, and it's always seemingly now a different horse, unless, of course, there's a Triple Crown on there. In this field specifically, like Mystic Dan and horses like that, like I was just ready for the newcomer or a new different type of horse to win this. I didn't think a horse that we had seen, you know, Seize the Gray or Mystic Dan were really all that special in this race. But Matt, go ahead with your selections in here.
This is a tough one, if I'm being honest. And obviously I'm happy to be here on the show, but talking through this race in particular, I sat in that Belmont betting challenge in a terrific spot waiting for this spot. Sierra Leone is a horse that my buddy Howard whispered to me 6 months ago. We had this massive future bet on him in the Kentucky Derby. That obviously ended up in flames. And as I just look back, it ended up being just the cruelest joke that somebody told him to tell me the name of this horse. At least for me, I feel like to some degree, selecting him as my all-in push in this tournament, it was both with head and heart.
Yeah.
I did absolutely believe him to be the best horse in the race. I also completely, well, I feel like I was projecting to some degree what I wanted to see. You know, I have complete faith in a trainer like Chad Brown and in the best jockeys in the world, whether it's Tyler or Flavian. I don't really make much of that jockey change. I think these guys are just both absolute pros. You know, maybe Chad felt he needed to do something there, but I thought he was the best horse in the race. I also wasn't blind to who the horse is. It's interesting, you know, so as I look at that selection, and yeah, I'm spoiling the race, but everyone knows what happened anyway. I don't blame the horse.
Yeah.
The horse is the horse. He did exactly what he does. I don't blame the jockey. The jockey knew exactly what to try to avoid and did his best. I don't blame the trainer. The trainer made a jockey switch, made an equipment change. I blame myself, right? I'm my own worst enemy. I didn't have to make this my big spot. I could have played this race differently, and I'll give a really good alternative to the way I played it in a second. But I just looked at this race and not really feeling like, you know, a horse doesn't owe you something when you bet him before and you lose. But I just thought this was this horse's chance for a nice redemption. And sure enough, slammed at the starting gate, bumper cars at the top of the stretch, paddling all the way. And it's like, yep, that's exactly what I was afraid was going to happen. And, you know, for me, what was so crushing on top of that was I thought there was really only one other horse in the race that could win. And that was Mind Frame. Mm-hmm. And that was my big hedge on the side, a massive exacta with Sierra Leone, a massive trifecta using all in the middle spot. And so on top of Sierra Leone, listeners will listen to what happened with that horse, but the sudden right turn that Mind Frame took also proved to be quite costly in the end. This was a tough one, but looking back, I mean, this is what the show's all about. I thought Sierra Leone was the best horse in the race. And in the context of a tournament where having the best horse in the race is very likely to win you the tournament, even if you think you should have had 5-2 instead of 8-5, it just doesn't make a difference.
Yeah.
In cash, it makes all the difference. But in the context of the tournament, and you need a win, I took what I thought was the most likely winner. And yeah, all right. Let's hear what you think. Play the tape and let's get on with it.
I mean, I'll keep it sweet and simple here. Like I said before, Seize the Gray, Mystic Dan kind of tosses for me. Antiquarian, not fast enough for Todd. And then you just get down to it. And exactly what you said, Mind Frame for me, when you run a 103 and then you go down to a 97 on a slower pace, I just don't know why the horse was going backwards. So I just kind of, you know, looking at it at 5-1, is absolutely playable, but just not for me in that spot. Cause I love Sierra Leone. This is the horse that I was not on as much in the Derby, but I definitely liked, you know, over the, over the Florida horse. And I just kind of felt that the Kentucky Derby race was what it was. This horse was probably the best in the race, and I'm getting above even money. And at that point, if you're good enough at this and you have good records and you feel like you're down to a one horse race and you're getting better than even money, and you're making money in the long run at it, this is the horse I wanted. So for me and Matt, it is Sierra Leone here in the Belmont. Let's hear what happened in this race replay here right now.
And they're off in the Belmont Stakes at Saratoga, presented by Naira Betts and Resilience. Broke alertly, so did Seize the Gray. And here's Dornick, headstrong in the early going. Mind Frame is four deep, but up and on the pace, and Antiquarian is just behind them in fifth. The Wine Steward is next. Kentucky Derby winner Mystic Dan will settle in mid-pack, about six lengths off the lead. It's a gap of five. Back to Protective. Sierra Leone got bounced around at the start, and Anna Marie is at the back back of the field, the opening quarter in just under 23 seconds flat. And it's Seize the Gray showing the way by a half length to Dornick in second. Mind Frame right together with Resilience, who's down on the inside fourth. Antiquarian is fifth between rivals, four lengths off the pace as they swing on to the Saratoga backstretch. It's another two to the New York bred, the Wine Steward, who races outside of Mystic Dan. Mystic Dan is now seven lengths off the lead. Another five lengths to Protective. Sierra Leone is allowed to go moderately at this stage. He has a lot of ground to make up as usual. And Anna Marie at the back, 47-1 for the Preakness winner, Seize the Gray, who heads past the half-mile pole, leading over Dornick, who's been pestering him the entire journey. Antiquarian trying to move up between rivals. Mind Frame is just outside of him. He just got his cue, and he's 3.5 lengths off the new leader, Dornick, who puts his head in front of Seize the Gray. Mind Frame moving in. Antiquarian, the Wine Steward, is next. Mystic Dan is still seven lengths off the lead. Sierra Leone launching his bid on the far outside as the field turns for home. Mind Frame on the outside is coming after Dornick, and it's Mind Frame and Dornick head in head with a furlong left to go. Sierra Leone is closing ground. It's Dornick hugging the rail. Mind Frame a little erratic, but he's still right there with Dornick in an absolute thriller. Dornick and Mind Frame, it will be Dornick and Luis Saez to win the Belmont Stakes at Saratoga.
Dornick getting the job done. We're looking at a win mutual of 37.40 and a buyer figure of 101, along with Mind Frame with a 101. Sierra Leone runs a 99. Give us, let's break down this race, Matt. Give me your thoughts.
I would have needed the all button. I would have needed probably seven selections in the race to get to Dornick. I'm no hater. I was actually super impressed with that win in the Risen Star when he came back. Mm-hmm. Certainly, and the race where I think it was the Bluegrass where he rated, right? It was an experiment. And, you know, we've also learned not to hold crazy Kentucky Derbies against horses. And so okay, looking back, was it findable? I suppose. I don't, even at juicy odds that pay $37, I'm not sure it was that great of value. It was about right. This is just one of those races where it's not that satisfying. Maybe it does make listeners feel better. If you let me play this race 100 times, erase my memory and play it again and again and again, I don't win this one time. The one comment I'll get to that I alluded to before, some really astute person, I think on Twitter, said, don't you think a decent alternative second play, given the way the track was playing, was a place bet on Mind Frame?
Yeah.
That's not a bad idea. I don't know I would have had the guts to do that. First of all, 680, it wouldn't have been if it was Sierra Leone that won, but it would have been about the same price that Sierra Leone paid to win. So I'll accept that the price would have been right. Look, you tell me. I think you're the host, I know, but you answer the question. Do you want Sierra Leone to win, or do you want Mind Frame to place if you're told they pay the same before the race? That's a tough one.
And again, I mean, just for the way you're supposed to be playing the gambling game in general, is you're looking for winners, not the place horses per se. Obviously, the way Barry Meadow talks about in his book, how you can manipulate the place pools and how you can put money down and, you know, edge out, you know, very, very small 1-2% gains to kind of supplement the losses in the win column. But I think Sierra Leone for the win is just how you have to go here. I already had kind of negative connotations toward Mind Frame, you know, whether the horse would run second or not. Once I kind of have a negative connotation, I'm usually out of the exacta with those type of horses. But I, for what you said, if you're betting this horse 100, betting the race 100 times, and I'm not picking Dornick once, $37 is too short, because even if it's, if you give every horse a 1% chance, that means the horse has to pay $100. No, thank you. So I think at the end of the day, this is one of those races that, you know, like we always say, you can't win them all. This is one that you literally cannot win, because the way your handicapping process is, there is one horse that you absolutely love, and then when they spring the latch, it's just based upon the gods at that point and just on your racing luck. And, you know, you talked about the paddling and getting bumped around bumper cars, and, you know, it to say it sucked is kind of, you know, just, you know, this horse running third in this type of field. I'm definitely going to look back at Sierra Leone now as, you know, not a downgrade, but I mean, it's not fun to watch who beats him in this race when I have, you know, it's going to take me 9 horses to get to Dornoch, and I'm already negative against Mindframe. How can you not say Sierra Leone is taking a little bit of a bump, you know, wherever this one ends up next, whether it's the Travers or the Jim Dandy or something like that?
Well, look, this horse for me is definitely taking a bump, but it's not in the direction you think. I am on permanent tilt with respect to this horse. And yeah. I don't care where this horse shows up again. I will be rooting for him with all my heart. I've loved following this horse for months, but any race that this horse is in is a pass for me going forward.
Yeah.
I won't know what to do. I won't be able to tell if it's my head or my heart. And it's similar to betting on friends' horses. I just don't do it. It's a terrific policy. In the long run, most people lose money betting on friends' horses anyways. You're always happy for them when they win. I'm going to look at this horse the same way. Mm-hmm. I'm just staying away. I'm definitely watching. I'm definitely interested. But this horse is not going to bite me again, period.
And listen, at some point, there's just the horses where you have to love with your heart, like you said, and just no matter what you do, they just never seem to reciprocate and give you the money back in your wallet. So I kind of see that, and I love the fact that it's not even that you're not going to play the horse, but you're just going to pass the races that it's in. It's a great idea and a policy. And overall, I guess I'll just ask, I didn't really prep you for this, but any thoughts on just the 3-year-old crop now going into the later half of the season and what you thought of the Triple Crown Trail?
Boy, I'm not prepared to call a crop weak because you get different winners.
Okay.
We'll see as it goes. Everyone wants to see the next flight line. Everyone wants to root for the next American Pharoah. Everyone wants to see some standout. That's not always what makes for the most competitive. You know, it's funny. I kind of think about the NCAA tournament a little bit. People love upsets. They love them mm-hmm. until the next game. And then it's a blowout. And that's not very fun. And yeah. So, I don't know. As you look at the... If there was some horse out there just demolishing everybody, okay. I mean, in the meantime, you've got horses that are highly competitive, each with some question marks. And I think there's a lot of really good betting races coming up. I just don't think that because these horses aren't invincible, I don't think it means that they're bad or subpar. I just think they're tough to distinguish.
I think that's a great way of looking at it. And that's a great way to actually end the podcast. And with that, I do want to thank my special guest, Matt Miller, for coming on, talking all things about the Belmont Stakes at Saratoga. Please get a chance to go out and buy his book, A Better Way of Thinking. Matt, any quick thoughts before we let you go for the night?
Just a little plug on that book. A Better Way of Thinking.com is where you can find it in hardcover. There's also a link to the ebook. And Pete Fornatail actually flew out and we recorded together. He voiced a couple of different voices in the book. We recorded an audio version. So that should be ready in a couple of weeks. And so however you take this stuff in, hopefully I put something out there that people find entertaining and helpful.
Thank you so much, Matt, for coming on. Really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
I want to thank everyone who listens to this show and the rest of the shows on the In the Money Media Network. Also want to thank my special guest, Matt Miller, for coming on, talking all things about the Belmont Stakes at Saratoga Race Course. This show has been a production of In the Money Media. In the Money Media's president is Peter Thomas Pornatal. Our chief creative officer is Jonathan Kinchin. And our In the Money Media business manager is Drew Coatney. I'm Spencer Luganbuehl. We will see you next time.